don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Teeton, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, December 5th, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at today. It's basically the usual three that we've had lately. We're going to be talking quite a bit about Obamacare. We're going to be talking quite a bit about the NSA spying, which, of course, is all done for our own best interest, right? Yeah, we all believe that. And we're also going to be talking about, hey, the money supply and all the interactions and permutations and combinations therefore. Among other things, we're going to look at what's going on with the Yellen, the Janet Yellen nomination and anointment. Is that the right word? But we're going to start off with a Nobel Prize winner who, among other things, says that there's a stock market bubble. Who'd have thought, Bill? How could they possibly come to the conclusion that there's a stock market bubble?
I don't know where they could have gotten. Maybe they listened to our show a couple weeks ago.
I think you deserve the economic prize myself, but, you know.
You had a good Thanksgiving?
You were on vacation? I did. Thank you very much. How about yourself?
Yeah, just fine. A couple of my daughters and fiance came over for Thanksgiving dinner and had a grand time.
And you had a great guest the week before Thanksgiving, too. It was a show that went very, very well.
Yes, yes. I was told it was very interesting, kind of talking about JFK, the Radical Tea Party president. Of sorts.
Interesting paradigm there, JFK Tea Party. Like, doesn't really normally fit in the typical paradigm.
Well, the title of the book is JFK Conservative, and making the case that he was his proposals were very conservative economically, which was an interesting discussion, and we kind of tied that into some of the things that are going on now and what he thought JFK would have done in similar circumstances to what Obama's doing. So it was a very interesting discussion. Of course, it's on the podcast list along with the other shows we've done.
Well, now that we're past Thanksgiving, we're closing in on Christmas, which means it's time for Christmas gifts. So what Christmas gifts did the Nobel Committee give us this year?
A Nobel Prize economist who's a Yale University economics professor, whose name I don't have. I can't find his name on my
list. Robert Shiller, I believe it is.
Oh, okay. Who made an interesting comment saying that he's worried. He's worried that the U.S. economy's fragility and vulnerability might not be able to withstand the stock market's current boom. He thinks it's a bubble, and speculation might end badly.
I love one quote from the Daily News article about his comments. The quote said, "Financial bubbles grow when investors do not notice that escalating asset prices bear little connection to market fundamentals." And I looked at that quote, and I said to myself, seriously, are there any investors out there who don't think or who do think that asset prices currently are governed by market fundamentals? Are there any out there at all?
I'm beginning to doubt. I think the consensus has pretty well been established that the entire stock market growth over the past 2 years is a consequence purely of the Fed's quantitative easing. Because, as usual, the quantitative easing, which is basically inflating the money supply, is beneficial to the people who can get the money first. And the people who are getting the money first are the big corporations that have excellent credit ratings, so they borrow money at ridiculously low interest rates and rebuy their own stock, which has the effect of increasing stock prices, which makes it look like there's a fantastic recovery going on when, in fact, it's just a monetary shuffle.
I'm glad that Yale University's economics department has figured out that bubbles exist in the stock market. I want to applaud them.
Of course, nobody recalls the dot-com bubble from 2001 to 2003.
Well, I do.
You remember that? It was way back when, before I was born.
Remember it? My business got clobbered by it. What are you talking about? I was selling long distance services, and they went, bye-bye.
Yeah, the dot-com bubble was a little bit different in that it wasn't totally a consequence of the Fed's easing, although it was easing plenty at that time under Bernanke. It was kind of a speculative bubble. In other words, they anticipated that a lot of these dot-com companies were going to be become billionaire corporations within a matter of months. So it was mainly irrational exuberance more than it was Fed monetary policy. But the current one is not. I mean, the new IPs that have been going up for the past couple of months show economic profiles of debt. They're not making money. They're not making profits, but they're going on as an IP, and there's all kinds of capital assets, capital gains that can achieved through an IP that is going to make the people issuing the stock very wealthy, but it has nothing to do with their ability to create a profit. So it's an interesting
contract. Let me get this straight. We have a debt-based fiat monetary system, a monetary system that is built upon and grows whenever debt is expanded, and that debt ultimately, as you pointed out, goes into the hands of the people who get to first spend it, which are the ones who make the most money off of it, and these people have basically put it into the hands of stocks that basically have inflated these stocks to hell in a handbasket because of all the debt that's involved in funding those stocks. So you're basically saying there's a connection between a debt-based monetary system and a debt-based stock market bubble? I'm shocked.
I'm glad you explained that to me.
I just like to remind our listeners that there actually is a cause and effect relationship going on here.
Well, I mean, there is a cause and effect relationship, but anyway, we're going to talk about Yellen later. One of the comments about Yellen was that her primary interest was psychology. Yeah. So the whole cause of this is not really monetary inflation. It's the illusion that the government can make the economy grow by creating more money. And so that's the illusion that creates all these bubbles, whether it's a housing bubble or a student loan bubble or whatever kind of bubble it is. It's just a psychological game that politicians play.
And in fact, not only is the stock market bubble an illusion, but the corporate profits behind it are also an illusion. So it's one complete illusion.
Yeah. Well, there was an interesting article in Forbes that actually looked at the statistics and showed that stock prices have not corrected 10% in over 2 years. 83% of the market opinion makers are bullish. They think that prices are going to continue to go up forever. At the peak of the market, in either 2000, during the dot-com bubble we talked about, or in 2007, it was a credit bubble, and it's exactly the same thing. The market right now is the Dow Jones at 26 times earnings. Today it's at 19 times earnings, but everybody is expecting that can't be sustained. Two out of three technology IPOs are being sold to the public without any profits at all. Earnings are being driven primarily by share buybacks. Driving the stock market prices is the growing awareness of the quantitative easing may be extended even further and indefinitely and forever by Yellen, by yelling very loud, "Hey, we got lots of money." So the money is sitting on the bank balance sheets, and it's not creating profits. It's just being used as leverage to increase the stock prices.
Yeah, to increase the stock prices and to increase everything else, too, including my stress levels.
Well, it gives, again, it's psychological. It gives the illusion that the economy is recovering, that things are going well, that all of the government intervention has been successful, and everything is just keen and dandy. Because the
in
Fed
fact,
has
the Fed Beige Book report came out saying that there was some modest but fairly substantial growth going on in the economy, and of course it turns out that the growth is purchased at a rather high price.
Well, I mean, when they talk about growth, they're talking about how much money moves. That's what the gross domestic product is. It's not actually product. It's not production. It's not that they're, you know, are more things being produced or there's more consumer activity, but that money is moving faster. In other words, it's going from one hand to another faster than it had in the past. That's what the GDP measures. Well, if the money is borrowed money and there's a lot more of it to bounce around, yeah, GDP goes up, but it's all just an illusion. It's just a fabrication from the fiat currency.
And in fact, I think you found an article somewhere that said that not only has it gone up, but it's gone up remarkably small amounts compared to how much money has been injected into the system. That's the part that's almost astonishing. I mean, it's not astonishing when you understand the nature of fiat money and when you understand the fact that such stimuluses really aren't productive. They may be productive in the short term, apparently, but in the long term, they're unproductive. And after a while, even in the short term, they're no longer productive. But the differential, the disparity between the amount of money put into it and the amount of money that they got out in terms of their GDP gain is such a large difference. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah, well, according to an article that was in the Wall Street Journal, they added up the numbers and they discovered that the Fed had injected $4 trillion into the economy over the past, 5 years, something like that?
That's
which resulted in a $40 billion gain in GDP. So it's like 1 to 100.
Yeah, 1%. They got a 1% gain. For every $100 you create, you got $1 worth of growth.
Woo-hoo! Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing is that the economy is really a secondary consideration. There are two considerations the Fed has to take care of, and which is what they're doing with quantitative easing. First of all, they have to make sure that the interest rate on U.S. Treasury bonds doesn't go up, because if it does, there's going to be a lot of unhappy politicians that see the interest rate they have to pay on this debt go from, 6% of the budget, something like that, to 10, 12, 14, 18, 20% of the budget. And that's going to totally blow away all of the financial expectations and budgeting for the next 10 years. Disregard Obamacare altogether. The other thing that they have to take care of is that they're still trying to bail out the financial sector that got involved in the housing boom. They're spending $40 billion every month. Now, imagine, you've got a budget. if you were spending $40 billion every month, you would think...
I'd either be bankrupt or rich, one or the other.
Yeah, one or the other. So they're spending $40 billion or $45 billion, whatever it is, buying up stock in Fannie and Freddie Mae. Is it Freddie Mac and Freddie Mae? Fannie Mae.
It's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
You've got to get the name straight here. Well, which are the federal home loan mortgage companies. there's two of them, so there's competition. It's a free market, you know, and that's how that works. So anyway, they're buying up stock, and where does the money go? It goes to pay off all the financial institutions that were authorizing and approving these totally preposterous mortgages. In other words, we're still suffering from what happened back 4 years ago, and they're still trying to fix it, and they still haven't fixed it because the price of housing and the number of new starts and so on is dead in the water and has been for the past 5 years. No effect whatsoever.
Kind of sad, really, when you think about it. Now, of course, with Super Yellen coming to the rescue, and rescue used in the literal term, there are now more and more articles on the web looking more in-depth at who Janet Yellen really is. And as you alluded to earlier, the New York Post published an article in which they cited the comments of a classmate of hers back in the, I guess it was in the early 60s or late 50s. I'm not sure exactly where it was. He was shocked, and he's a Wall Street guy, and he was shocked at how high her rise has been, how spectacular it's been, because, as he said, her great interest was the psychology club.
Yeah, well, and that's what it is. It's all psychology. It's all what you can make people imagine is actually happening. If you can persuade them to believe that the government is actually fixing things, that's what's important. It doesn't matter whether you're actually doing anything constructive or valuable or important. It's just giving the illusion that you're doing something that's going to help people out in general. So it's all psychology.
One of the interesting things to me from that article at the Post was the last paragraph. And I don't know, you may not even noticed it, but I noticed it. Let me read it to you. It said, in 2004, she, Janet Yellen, became president of the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco and has been credited with recognizing the subprime mortgage crisis earlier than other economists. And she's currently the Fed's vice chair. Well, I thought that was an interesting claim. So I went over to Wikipedia because, of course, they're equally a reliable source. And according to the Wikipedia article, she did, in fact, in 2004, observe that there was a bubble in process. And in 2005, in a speech she made in San Francisco, she argued against deflating the housing bubble, against it. And her reason was arguments against trying to deflate a bubble outweigh those in favor of it. And she predicted that the housing bubble, quote, could be large enough to feel like a good-sized bump in the road, but the economy will likely be able to absorb the shock, unquote. And then in 2010, Yellen told the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that she and other San Francisco Fed officials looked for guidance from Washington, particularly regarding countryside mortgage, because that was based, as it happens, in association with her district within the Federal Reserve. But they looked for guidance because, quote, she had not explored the San Francisco Fed's ability to act unilaterally in regard to the lending involved, unquote. You know, it's like, okay, so the New York Post is saying that she should be recognized for having noticed that there was going to be a crisis before everybody else. But as it turns out, her recognition basically led to her not taking any action at all because she didn't have guidance from Washington on what action to take. And on top of that, she decided that it was better not to deflate the housing bubble. Well, what good is it to have advanced sight if you project the wrong solution?
Well, because the most important thing is psychological. It's all wishing and hoping. If as long as you wish and hope hard enough, then it won't be a problem.
You wish upon a Fed.
There you go.
No matter if you're in bed.
No, I'm sorry. Well, there were literally dozens of different private market, free market economists who recognized the housing bubble long before the turn of the century. Yellen noticed it because Countrywide went belly up. It was hard to ignore that. And then, of course, the solution that was imposed on Countrywide was that they were forced to sell everything to Bank of America, and Bank of America got a nice big fat bailout from the federal government so that they could clean up the mess that Countrywide had made, which was a consequence of the laws that had been passed by Congress encouraging banks and financial institutions to make loans that would never be paid back.
And that's why Yellen has been a strong supporter of expanding the money supply dramatically to, among other things, fund the government in its efforts to reverse the course, so to speak, to, in essence, cover up the mess that was created by spending more money. And where is the money currently being spent? Well, it's being spent in a lot of ways, but the one big project that everybody knows about because it's in the news is Obamacare! Hey! Although it turns out that the support for Obamacare is shifting. I don't know if you saw that, but there was a poll that was released by the Harvard Institute of Politics. They released this just a couple days ago, and they had five key findings that they highlighted in that poll. The very first finding that they highlighted was that support from Obamacare among the young has plummeted. That's kind of surprising because it was the young, it was basically the 18 to 29 age group or thereabout that was, it was one of the three factors. Everybody, all the political scientists agree, those are one of the three factors that got Obama elected and then reelected. And in fact, they were the ones who were so strongly behind Obamacare.
I think it's a consequence of the media coverage of the fact, the basic Obamacare fact, that they have to get these 18 to 29-year-olds, well, actually it's 26 to 35-year-olds, to buy insurance that they wouldn't otherwise buy, and particularly prepackaged insurance that they certainly have no use for. And so the concern about the Obamacare website and the enrollment is that 4 out of 5 of the people that are going on the site are ending up in Medicaid, and they aren't getting enough of the young, healthy kids persuaded to buy insurance to cover the costs of all these additional benefits and subsidies and everything else. And so they're suddenly realizing that they are the ones that are going to be the victims of Obamacare. They are the ones that are going to pay the difference for the old dying, unhealthy people that are getting policies at cheap prices. The young people are the ones that are going to pay for it. And I think the young people are just suddenly, slowly beginning to realize that they are going to be the victims in this whole game.
Yeah, they're going to be the biggest victims. I think everybody's going to be victims, but they're definitely going to be the biggest victims.
There was an interesting psychological footnote in that particular study, and that was they asked the 3 different questions about the ACA,
right.
The Affordable Care Act, and Obamacare.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they asked, do you approve of the program? And if they asked about ACA, 57% disapprove, but only 31% think it will increase costs, and only 40% think the quality of care will falter. Now, if they ask exactly those same 3 questions but use the term Obamacare, then there was a 1-4% change in the people's opinions.
That's very small. That's a lot smaller than what we've seen in other polls, which means the young have been paying attention to the news, or either that or else they've been listening to our broadcast. I'm not sure which.
That has to be what it is. All the 18 to 29-year-olds are listening to Freedom News Hour. but the interesting thing about the poll was that 1-4% change bounced both ways. In other words, it wasn't just that it went for or against something named Obamacare, or for or against something ACA, the opinions about approval or disapproval and so on, they all bounce back and forth, up or down. what's amusing to me was a survey question whether or not those 18 to 29-year-olds who did not have health insurance would be buying it. Only 1/3 say that they're likely to enroll in the exchange. Apparently they missed the news item that said that it was against the law for them not to enroll. That is a mandate, and that there is a legal penalty, which the Supreme Court has called a tax, but it is a legal penalty for not enrolling.
And they'll find that out within the next year and a half. The interesting part, though, is that their intention would be not to enroll, and that's really bad news for the pro-Obamacare people. Because they're counting, as you pointed out, they're counting on that group to basically fund the system. And that group also elected almost all the Democrats, including President Obama. That's a serious problem for the Democrats. I don't know how they're going to walk back from that one.
Well, one way they walk back from it is that they postpone whatever they can. For example, they don't want people to realize before the next election that their employer health insurance package is going to get canceled, that their employers are going to stop providing health care services through their job. They don't want people to realize that there are somewhere between 30 and 40 million people that are suddenly going to go to work a few days after the election and get a little pink slip in there saying, sorry, we're going to have to terminate your medical insurance. There are new programs available. Here's the Obamacare exchange you can go to get it.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's one way that they cope with it.
And when that happens, all heck breaks loose.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some distress. after the election is all over, it won't matter, though, because they've got another 2 years for both Obama and the Congress to diddle around.
Perhaps, and I think it's actually a stretch of the imagination to say that it gets them through the 2014 midterm elections. But assuming for the sake of discussion that it actually does get them through that, or maybe even through the 2016 presidential election, ultimately, this is really, really bad for the Democratic Party brand for the long term, because they're essentially undermining one of their most important constituencies. And this is not a constituency that's going away. This is the constituency that becomes the next middle-aged group and then the next senior group. I mean, this is a significant thing.
Well, I mean, one of the things you didn't know because you didn't read it before the Congress voted on it was that this whole Obamacare program goes into effect over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. There are provisions in the law that don't go into effect until much later. They did the pre-existing conditions immediately. They did you can stay on your parents' health insurance until you're 26. If you're on your parents' health insurance and if the insurance company doesn't raise the rates and if the insurance companies offer a family package, all of those if, ands, or buts. So here's why it won't affect the 2014 elections, and that is because during 2014, you're supposed to have medical insurance. It's required by law. You're supposed to get it, you know, through the Obamacare exchange or something that's compatible with it, and you get a tax credit, and isn't that marvelous? But you won't see what the tax credit is and whether or not the insurance company took too much or too little based upon their estimates or your income until April of 2015. When you do your taxes in April of 2015, you're going to get a little piece of paper that says, oops, we spent more on your health insurance than your tax credit is, so you're going to owe an additional X amount of dollars to the federal government that you cannot take as a tax credit. But we've already spent that.
Actually, I'm not so sure that that's going to be considered shocking. And I know that's a weird thing to say, particularly for me, but the reason I say that is I continued on my quest to see if I could actually get anywhere on healthcare.gov. And you'll remember that my first attempt, the email never actually arrived, you know, 3 weeks later, still not there. And my second attempt got me to the last step, but then once I got the last step, they basically had nothing to show me. Well, they now have something to show me. They basically tell me that if I enroll my wife and I in this program, we'll save $184 a month. Woohoo! Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah.
But well, here's what they don't tell you. Here's what they don't tell you.
Yeah.
They don't tell you what coverage you get.
Right.
They don't tell you anything about your doctor network.
Or
they don't tell you anything about where you're going to get to spend any of this, what's going to be covered, where the exclusions. They tell you none of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if people enroll in all this stuff, and I think there's some serious question as to how many will enroll, but let's assume for the sake of discussion that people en masse do enroll in this, and they enroll into the program sight unseen because we're from the government and we're here to help you.
Yeah, well, I mean, after you get enrolled and you actually start your policy in January 1st, you're going to get a nice little packet in the mail, and it's going to be a 27-page, 6-point type exposition from the insurance company as to what provisions apply to you.
And if people will get through the form, they won't read it.
Standard, and nobody's going to read it. It's going to all be standard boilerplate, and nobody will realize what the consequences are until they start putting in insurance claims.
Right.
And it's only going to be a little one-at-a-time thing. Oh, you went to visit your doctor for this. You know, there's a $15 copay on that visit, you know, in spite of the fact you got insurance. You had to have gallbladder surgery? Well, notice in clause 247 that there is a $5,000 deductible. It only costs
$4,000. That's clause 247,000, not 247. Sorry.
You know, and so the only people who are going to realize that they're not getting anything for the dollars they're spending are those who actually try to take advantage of the insurance coverage, and they're not going to realize it until after they get the bill.
And speaking of taking advantage, as we've talked about before, that's ultimately what's going to really bring the thing down, if it hasn't already crumbled under its own weight by that point. And that is, people will take advantage of it in the form of the fact that you can't be turned down for insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. And essentially, that's what ends Obamacare, no matter how you look at it. But it also is what makes everybody else's lives miserable because now all of a sudden, their rates start going up.
The rates that they couldn't afford in the first place. No.
Giving them the
Affordable Care Act. You know, the rates can't go up. Supposed to make it more affordable.
You don't realize they left the first two letters off. It's the Unaffordable Care Act.
It's all psychological. Keep telling yourself it's going to work.
Oh, dear. Well, let's pick up on this after the break, and then we'll also take a look at what's going on with the NSA, our favorite secret spy force, because they're always a lot of fun, too. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Walt Thiessen and Bill Westmiller here on this Thursday, December 5th, 2013. And, Bill, we were talking not only about Obamacare, but at the top of the hour, we're talking about Wall Street and the monetary system and so forth. And one of the points that you made was that the overwhelming sentiment right now on Wall Street and throughout the investment world is that happy days are here again. The stock market is not in a bubble situation. Things are just going to keep going up, 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 and up, and all wonderful things are happening. And there have been many times in my life, I don't know about you, but many times in my life where I wondered about how it could be that so many people who were very intelligent people could delude themselves that way. And the same thing could be said for, say, Obamacare. I mean, so many people deluding themselves that you can actually put a program into place that will always cover pre-existing conditions and keep costs under control and cover everybody, and it won't cost anybody anything, and you'll be able to keep your coverage and yada yada, and all this other stuff. But there is a similarity between those two, and there's actually a point of commonality, and that point of commonality is a point that I've referred to quite a bit lately. I just want to bring it up one more time. It's storytelling. And frankly, the people who you referred to, the people who are the opinion makers, when you talked about the Wall Street influencers, the ones who are putting out the information that says, the sky's the limit. We're just going to keep growing and growing and growing. This is all wonderful. The stories that these guys tell, men and women, the stories that these people tell are compelling stories, and their subscribers get all caught up in the stories. And that's how you end up with very intelligent investors making very bad investment decisions. The stories regarding Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, same thing. Lots of really effective storytelling going on. So, again, I think this is one more time to recognize and remind ourselves it's the power of storytelling that drives us not only in every aspect of our lives, but drives us to the greatest catastrophes, because there's very little actual connection between most stories and most reality. Because stories are basically made up. They're fictional. They're designed to present a particular viewpoint and to sell a particular idea and to hell with reality.
Question of how loud you can yell.
And how many people you can yell to.
And if you're a yelling person, then you're doing fine.
And that's why they're so glad that yelling is going to be the next Fed chair.
No, of course you're right. I mean, it's Obama has always been an expert at rhetoric, and it's called dialectical materialism. In other words, the dialect, the way you tell the story.
Are you playing a little Hegelianism on us here?
It's all the dialectic way you tell a story, and the moral, and so on. Everybody deserves to have free health services. And that's a natural human right, and therefore, it doesn't matter, that we're getting little bumps in the road along the way. We're doing the right thing and the good thing, and we're making sure that the people who like their health insurance are able to keep it, and the people who like their doctor are going to keep it, but we're just going to make it universal so that everybody can enjoy this right to health care.
Well, of course there's a right. I mean, I can name one union right off the top of my head that completely understands the fact that health care is a right. That would be the Service Employees International Union, because they're the ones who've gotten the states to basically require medical workers to join their particular enclave of medical care, whether they want to or not, because that's what a right is all about, right?
Well, it's one of dozens of different aspects and reasons why government isn't business. Government does things by forcing people into groups, and therefore it's very uncomfortable when the government has to negotiate with health workers and facilitators and all this stuff from two or three or five or sometimes even 10 different organizations. So they want to get it all into the same one organization so they can sit down at the table with one person and come to some agreement or consensus about how to proceed. It's extremely complex to do things in the free market system, where you have to deal with all kinds of different suppliers and vendors and doctors and hospitals and medical centers and all this kind of stuff. It's just too complex for the government to deal with. And so they've got to force people into boxes so they can move boxes around. And that's
Now, one of the boxes, I think your analogy of boxes is a good one, but the whole boxes strategy does have a major flaw. And the major flaw is it comes in the form of what happens when you try to force somebody into a box and the prevailing climate prevents you from doing so. Case in point, the fact that small businesses are not going to be required to participate in the Affordable Care Act until, was it 2015 or something like that?
Yeah.
Which basically means, I don't know what the number of workers are involved that we're talking about here, but I'm sure it's a large number, well into the millions. Basically, we have a new pool of people who are going to be thrust into the exchanges who were not previously expected to go into the exchanges, at least not the way that the original plan was laid out. That's an interesting problem of boxes right there.
Yeah, well, it's only a problem for the people who don't comply with the standard wisdom. I mean, it's the small businesses that say, well, you know, I can't really afford this, and so they try to persuade them by imposing a $3,000 fine per employee that they have, if they have 50 or more, to persuade them that they need to provide some kind of health insurance. Of course, they don't have to provide health insurance. They can pay that fine. But the people, the individual employees, then are required to get health insurance in any case, whether they're getting from their employer or not.
Well,
they're going to end up on the exchanges.
Because even if they volunteered to sign up for the program for their business, they still can't do it because they can't even begin enrollment until a year from now.
Right, because the computer system isn't set up and isn't operating. I mean,
so it really doesn't matter whether they're willing to provide it or not. Their employees are basically going to be thrust on exchanges anyway.
Yeah. It's.
I mean, that's a part.
Yeah, I've kind of poo-pooed this initial problem with the rollout of the website because those are all technical problems and they're eventually going to work through them. But I was a little bit surprised that they actually admitted that they could not get the employer system working for another year, even though it was supposed to be part of the October 1st rollout. And so, contrary to the specifications and requirements in the law, Obama said, well, you know, we can't do it, so we'll just postpone it for a year. You know, wait until after the next election. And, you know, then people will find out what's in the ACA, even though they still haven't read it, and probably Obama hasn't read it because he didn't quite understand this grandfathering clause, even though his own advisors, you know, did an analysis, the Office of Management and Budget, did an analysis saying that the grandfather clause is only going to cover 10 to 20% of the employer health insurance programs, which means that 80 to 90% of those programs are going to become extinct. They're going to disappear.
Well, not only did he not understand the grandfather clause, he didn't understand the uncle clause either, because, I mean, we've been reading about his uncle, too. But on top of all that, he did apparently understand the Santa Clause, because he is now apparently dispensing the goodies that Santa Claus does. I mean, I'm basically expecting a white beard to appear on his face any day now.
NORAD is now controlling Santa Claus's route, you know. So everything is fine. It's all standardized. It's all stable. We know exactly where Santa's going to be, exactly what route he's taking, and you know, the NSA is going to keep monitoring his progress and reporting it on MSNBC or whatever.
New pieces of information from our friend Edward Snowden suggesting exactly how they're managing to do the monitoring. It turns out, we've just learned in the last day or two, that the NSA has been gathering data on cell phone locations globally, and that the number of reports that they collect exceeds 5 billion so forth on hundreds of millions of cell phones, many of which are American cell phones.
Well, you have to remember Eric Clapper. No. They're not doing that. Well, not intentionally.
Not intentionally, that's
right. It's purely accidental that they're collecting that information.
And it's just by accident that they also have Santa Claus's cell phone and that they're monitoring his cell phone. That's how they know where he is. You ever wonder how they could actually do the global positioning? They have to have a sensor, right? What's a cell phone, for goodness sake?
Well, there's an interesting, I mean, we can't get too much into the weeds on these things, but the NSA has always admitted that it got the metadata on telephone calls and internet transactions and so on. And they always said, well, you know, it's the telephone number of the call. We don't know whose telephone number that is. We couldn't possibly find out. We don't have any yellow pages or white pages here. And then it has the who you called, duration of
that's awesome.
Duration of the call, and so on and so forth. So they had like four or five different data bits, and that's what they admitted that they were collecting, right? Or at least they admitted it after Snowden revealed it. But what they didn't say was that in the metadata that's being sent to them by the various phone companies and internet services, there are some additional fields. One of the additional fields is the cell tower. And for every cell call, there's a code that identifies which cell tower handled that outgoing call. So, of course, they don't have access to the number to identify which cell tower it was and where it was and that you were in proximity to that cell tower and you were driving from here to there and so on. They don't. That just accidentally happens to be there. And, of course, is nothing they're going to use. The other field that's in there is financial transaction data. In a lot of the metadata for telephone calls and internet transactions, there is a field for credit card number. And so in addition to all the other information in this metadata batch, they are getting credit card numbers of everything you buy online or by phone. So those are just two of the fields, and there's probably dozens of others that identify various characteristics of the call that they claim that they have no interest in, even though it happens to be part of the data set they're collecting.
Right, because they only look at stuff accidentally.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, there did you know that there is a land bloom in swampland off the coast of Florida?
Okay. You don't have a bridge yourself? We get little tidbits of things that are happening totally independent of the telephone calls and the internet transactions. One of the things that happened the other day was that a woman who was planning on going to New York City for a 10-day Caribbean cruise was stopped in Toronto. She already paid her ticket for the cruise. The customs and border agents would not allow her to get on the airplane to fly to the U.S. The reason why they denied her the information was that they looked in their databases and they discovered that a few years back, she went to the hospital and was treated for clinical depression. And therefore, she was not eligible because Homeland Security said that people who had been hospitalized for depression might be suicidal terrorist bombers. Now, how did the people at the Toronto airport, who were U.S. agents, get the information about her hospital treatment? Well, they got it from either Medicare, which Part D reports all of the prescription information you've got, or they got it from another department that manages all of the doctor medical records and is trying to centralize them just like the NSA. Now, who has access to that information? FBI, DEA, NSA has access to all that medical information, and they could decide that, well, you know, you were depressed 5 years ago, and so we can't let you into the country. Now they're more depressed. They have to get more drugs. So it's a vicious cycle. So one of the things that people don't realize is that all of this data capture thing is actually a subdivision of the NSA. And the subdivision is called F6. And F-6 is a cooperative venture between the NSA and the CIA to collect data. So not only is all this NSA information going into the NSA troves, it's being provided also full access to the CIA. And whenever there is any suspicion that there's criminal activity involved, it also goes to the FBI. And if there's any indication that there's international travel involved, it goes to the Border Patrol. If they think it has anything to do with drugs, it goes to the DEA. So this whole thing is not just the NSA. It is a whole host of different government departments that are sharing all this information. And in some cases, they have actually instructed people like the DEA, don't tell them where you got the information. When you go to court to lay charges, do not say that we gave you the information on this person's, you know, metadata from their phone conversations to their drug dealers.
Right, because they shared it inadvertently.
Right, it was accidental.
Completely accidental. Never mind the fact that Ellen Richardson is a paraplegic, so she's basically in a wheelchair, and she was the purpose of her visit. Remember, you said that she had been treated for depression. The purpose of her visit was to go to the Caribbean for a 10-day vacation, which of course would be a horrible thing to do for somebody who's in a case of a state of depression. I mean, it might actually cure them. You know, so her cover story of going to the Caribbean was obviously completely unbelievable. She had to be stuffing, some sort of a dynamite solution into the tubes of her wheelchair so she could wheel onto the plane and blow it up. Yeah, that's got to be it.
That's the logic of trying to put people in boxes.
How are we doing with the storytelling?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole purpose of the NSA and the CIA and the FBI is to protect us from what might happen. You know, it's got nothing to do with the Fourth Amendment, where you actually have to prove that somebody is involved in a criminal activity before you can take their stuff. You know, they can't do that.
Absolutely. I mean,
and protect us from future threats. You know,
well, sure. There is a. I don't know if you have any idea of how great the risk is of having a broken leg from having a wheelchair fall on you.
Hmm.
I mean, we're talking serious national security threat here.
No. The serious national security threat was not from the wheelchair. It was from this woman who was so suicidal and therefore probably decided that she should hide all the explosives in her attaché case so that she could blow up the airplane because she didn't want to die alone.
Actually, the left wheel of the wheelchair was an Uzi.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what it really was.
Alan, we're really stretching the story a little there, Walt.
But it's all accidental. None of it's intentional.
So anyway, I mentioned that all these different departments are getting NSA data, but actually a lot of them are doing their own NSA dirty work. The FBI has its own unit, Signal Intelligence Unit, called the Data Intercept Technology Unit, pronounced D2. and they are involved, and this is another NSA document that came from Snowden, that they are playing a pivotal role
in
the NSA prison system, or PRISM system. My tongue is not working today. So anyway, they are part of the flow chart. They are collecting their own information over and above what NSA is collecting, and so they're doing their own thing as well.
Well, it's nice to know that the FBI is cooperating with the NSA. You know, that just makes you feel real secure, don't you think?
Well, remember the whole reason for developing the Department of Homeland Security was that there were all of these organ tubes where all the information was controlled. The CIA didn't talk to the FBI. FBI didn't talk to the DEA. And
exactly.
So the problem was you had to put them all in the same department and force them all to talk to each other to reveal their secrets to the other people so that the other people could stop the terrorists from doing nasty things.
And, of course, the fact that we were kind of underestimating what they'd be talking about. Well, you know, that's just, you know, collateral damage. That's all that is, right?
there's still, what is it, 90% of the NSA documents that Snowden haven't been revealed yet? And like I mentioned a few years ago.
I think it's 99%, actually. The Guardian, I don't know if you read about it, but the British police are basically thinking of charging the Guardian with violating espionage laws.
Yeah.
And one of the things that came out of that is the Guardian said they've released 1% of it. 1%.
Yeah.
So 99% has yet to come.
So what do you think is in the other 99%?
Probably the end of the world as we know it.
Well, I suggested a few weeks back that I suspect there is a lot of a whole new classification of data that they are intercepting, and that is every financial transaction in the world. And I suspect that they are doing that because basically they've said they are doing that in roundabout words, and they are using that information to collect strategy information on foreign businesses and then providing that information to U.S. businesses, particularly defense contractors, of course, so that they can be competitive with these foreign nations. So the goal here is to collect enough information to make U.S. companies more competitive in the world in terms of creating bombs conducting their business of buying oil and everything else from around the world. So I think that's what's the residue so far that we've got. There may also be something in there about collection of content, because back in 2004, I remember when there was this ruckus over Ashcroft approving programs, the FBI was getting reports from the NSA that they were going to investigate U.S. persons. Where a terrorist called a pizza shop and 200 other people called a pizza shop. In the course of their one- and two-hop process, they had lists of people who were relatives of all the people who had called the pizza shop that the terrorist had also called. And the FBI was screaming, saying, "This is insane. We can't possibly use this information. It's totally useless. And we're totally wasting our time trying to go through it." So just trying to go through haystacks to find needles is not working well.
No, it doesn't really work very well. And I guess the lesson, is there a lesson to be learned from all this? I mean, I guess there are probably a million lessons. But I guess the one that comes to my mind is, did you ever get the feeling we're living in a Robert Ludlum novel? I mean, I'm thinking like the Bourne novels, right, where basically they tracked Bourne everywhere around the world. Didn't matter where he was, they could track him everywhere. If he got somebody else involved, they knew all about her within seconds and so on and so forth. I mean, we live in that world now. We actually lived in it for like the last 10 to 15 years and didn't know it. Now we know it.
Yeah, you get the 1984 correlations and so on. But actually, the way they're doing it, it reminds me of Maxwell Smart.
Yeah. Chaos.
However, there's good news on the horizon. There are a couple of lawsuits challenging the NSA that are making good progress, and there's actually a bill in the U.S. Congress introduced by Justin Amash in the House and Rand Paul in the Senate that basically would eliminate all of the collection of domestic data from the NSA.
A happy note to end on. Terrific! Hey, we actually did it! Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Thank you.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Talk about it.